ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Why did Matthew Flinders write such saucy letters to his best friend, George Bass?
Who really chopped off Chopper's ears?
And why did they name a swimming pool after an Australian Prime Minister who drowned?
These are the kind of historical questions we'll be asking on The Dead Can't Sue.
So join me, Alicia Simmons.
And me, Lee Boucher.
Find it by searching for The Dead Can't Sue on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
The video game industry has always loved a dramatic plot twist, but lately it feels like someone has hit fast forward. Physical game discs are disappearing. Consoles and games cost more than ever. Thousands of people are losing their jobs, including the teams making games more accessible. And every company seems convinced that artificial intelligence is the answer to absolutely everything. So, is this another awkward growing pain for an industry that never seems to stand still? Or are we watching the biggest reset in gaming since everything went online? Plus, why is the UN speaking out against killer robots? My name is Ray Johnston, and welcome to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. Now joining me to unpack some of the biggest stories in tech right now and why they matter is Kai Riemer, Professor at the University of Sydney Business School. Welcome back, Kai.
Thanks for having me.
And Gianfranco Di Giovanni, otherwise known as Gianni, games reporter at ABC Arts and 102.5 ABC Perth content director. Welcome back, Gianni.
G'day.
Now, the video game industry is changing faster than most players can keep up with. So let's give it a crack, shall we? Microsoft have laid off thousands of staff, including people working on accessibility. How significant is this latest round of cuts, Gianni?
It's a pretty big one. I think what should be sort of put into perspective is some of those studios at Microsoft that they've sort of accumulated over a long period of time have really kind of been cut in half. And we're talking about studios like id Software, which was a legacy studio that made the Doom series of games, made the Wolfenstein games. They've effectively been cut in half. Half their staff, according to some reports, are gone now entirely. That also goes for studios like Obsidian, which made the original action RPGs and made things like Fallout New Vegas. They've apparently lost half their staff as well. And so many of the studios that were acquired as part of this sort of gold rush of accumulation of talent and IP during the, the Phil Spencer era of Xbox are gone. So things like Double Fine and Compulsion Games and Ninja Theory, all of those studios have now been spun off into their own thing. So this is a really significant reorganization of Xbox. And I think there's going to be a really different look of what that company will within Microsoft will look like in the next couple of months and years.
Absolutely. And Microsoft is investing quite heavily in AI at the same time as making these cuts. Is AI playing a role in the job losses, Kai?
Probably. In two different ways, right? On the one hand, AI is being used in software development itself. Now, we've seen cuts across many IT software as a service companies, but they were much smaller, usually around 5 to 10%, 7% is what Meta cut and a few others, Atlassian, which is sort of a, some people said it was more like a cyclical reaction because we've, you know, sort of gorged up on STEM talent for quite a while, as you said, during COVID and a bit of a boom in software as a service. So part natural correction, a little bit around AI, but software development is changing, but this doesn't explain a 20% cut. And what is happening here is that the industry is facing lots of cost pressures, and the cost pressures right now are coming from an uptick in hardware prices, especially storage and RAM, so memory. It used to be GPUs that were really expensive, and they're still not cheap. But the latest impact of the AI boom, meaning building big data centers, inference machines, people are buying Mac minis and lots of computers to run agents on, has played out in storage and in RAM. And if you're building a console, which is sort of very tightly packed hardware, what you pay for those components is quite significant. So consoles, PCs, all the hardware's going up, that goes towards affordability. Affordability is not great in the economy right now at anyway. So, you know, demand for games might drop, or, you know, gamers might make more cost-conscious decisions, which all impacts the industry, which then impacts the economic decisions that the industry has to make. Hence, that might explain, in a roundabout indirect way, some of those cuts.
Absolutely, yeah. Ramageddon, I believe, is the term that's being bandied around at the moment about lack of memory.
And it is significant, right? So depending on where you look at it, it's up between 2 and 5 times. I think in the RAM that you need for a good game computer, so 64 gig RAM, it sets you back about $1,000, where it was about $250, $300 maybe. Depending on how you look at it and depending in what currency. But it is quite significant year on year. So if you look a year ago, it was much, much cheaper. And that's not negligible when you look at the prices for a console or what it takes to put a game PC together.
Absolutely. So meanwhile, while all this is happening, we've got Sony, Xbox, publishers like Rockstar as well, all moving away from physical discs. It looks like having a disc that you put into a console it's ended. We're at the end of an era. Why are they doing this, Gianni?
I think it's interesting. Like, I think the parallel between what's happened with Xbox and what's going to be happening with PlayStation and also with the new GTA game that's coming out is that games are moving from a product that you buy to a service that you pay for and subscribe, right? And so that was the big bet that Xbox made. They said that if we buy up every studio that we possibly can and we make a very compelling product that you would subscribe to every single month for a long period of time, then that becomes a more sustainable business model than making a big hit and hoping that it sells a lot of things. And so by not having those physical copies of games around anymore, you're not going to lose those sales where you know, I even did this in the office the other week, actually, where I picked up one of my PlayStation games and handed it to one of my colleagues and lent it to them, right?
We're not going to be able to do that anymore.
We can't do that anymore. So, you know, that is, if we both want to play this game, we both need to subscribe to this service going forward. What I think will be the interesting comparison is, so if you look at, you know, a lot was made of GTA, the new GTA game, which is coming out in November, not being available on a disc at all, right?
Yeah.
That game came out originally on, like, the previous one came out on the Xbox 360, right? So it's hard to argue that what was on the disc for that game is the same as what you play now. These games expand and they grow and they go from all those sorts of things. But that being said, how do you preserve these things too? Like, that's my big concern. Like, you know, you can have all these games. You're not going to get like a snapshot of what that game was at that time, because if the server gets shut down, if studios get shut down, if all of these things happen like we've just seen with Xbox and they decide, okay, that's it, we're not making these things anymore and it's all gone, then it's gone. So, like, that's a cultural problem, I think, from moving to this sort of subscription-based system where everything is just on an online store and we can download these things all the time. By not having a physical copy of stuff, you do run into an issue. And where I think the comparison is slightly different, because in PC gaming, it has sort of been a thing where digital downloads has really taken off, and it's been, you know, the predominant way to play games for such a really long time. You could actually buy games from multiple different places on a PC, right? But on a PlayStation console, on an Xbox, there's still only one place that you can buy games from. So there's also like a competitive argument to be made that by not having physical copies of things, where you could go to this shop down the street and get a slightly cheaper price than that shop down the street, that the consumer, for example, might be at a disadvantage where there isn't that competition as well. And so that's where I wonder whether our ACCC might actually come in and say, hey, actually, this might not be the best thing for consumers, and we might see something happen slightly differently, because they have intervened in this sort of thing in the past.
I think it's also sort of a mirror image of what's going on in software development more broadly. I mean, it's been a gradual process, right? We've moved away from the idea that you can buy a piece of software or game on a hard disk, then install it and just play it without online registration for quite a while. So in the interim, they have become sort of the physical medium by which you get the data, but you still had to have an account, and then the game would be linked to your account with a key, with a code, and you couldn't give it to your friend anyway because you had already registered it to your account, and they would have to buy their own key, right? You can give them the CD, but it just saves you from downloading it. But as broadband is more common and a gigabyte download isn't that much of a problem anymore, it's just cheaper also to do that. And also it ties in with how we develop software these days, right? We develop software on an ongoing basis. We're not having big releases twice a year. And so if you want to update the game, you're basically downloading those updates anyway. And gamers actually also want new content. They want new seasons. They want regular new stuff happening in the game. And so that lends itself to online delivery. And therefore, why not get rid of the disc? Because then you can get rid of the drive in your hardware. You can make the hardware smaller. You can give it an edgy design. Right? You're not bound by having to find that slot for the CD. The CD can break, so it makes the whole box much less sort of prone to hardware failure. So there's a whole bunch of reasons that really, really kind of push towards online download. And then, of course, going all in, you're just not doing download anymore. You're just streaming it. But then, yes, all what Gianni said applies, because you can't share it, you can't preserve it. You're really very much dependent on that server being available. If the server is down, you're not gaming. And that's basically the world we live in any content, right? For better and for worse, that's the business model. We're streaming every other content, and we're losing something in the process for sure.
Is holding on to discs, is mourning discs, are we just not wanting to move on and accept our current reality? Is this just something we need to deal with? Gianni, what do you think?
Oh, it's sad, isn't it? I'm really sad about it.
I'm so sad. I didn't expect to have these many feelings about it.
I have a big collection of things from the past, and you know, some of those first games that I played when I was a kid, I've still got them and they still work, right? And so those are some of the things that, you know, if I wanted people to play them down the track, they can. And so the sort of ever-increasing move towards the service model for pretty much everything that we have, right?
Yeah.
I think that actually makes it like it is kind of hard for us to sort of attach those things, that sort of feeling to that, because like if you just subscribe to it and then it stops, then, you know, you don't have that physical object. And even with a lot of the independent games that have released first as just a digital download, because they're small and independent and they become really popular and successful, they actually end up as part of the sort of gaming culture. They get a physical release. I can think of like Untitled Goose Game, right?
Yeah.
That game came out originally just as a download, and because it was so popular, it actually got put onto a real cartridge, onto a real disc. And so that things can be preserved because of that. But that is part of the culture of games and the playing of games, is that having those little objects and having those things in your little library, much like we would have record libraries or CD libraries, that's part of the culture of being a fan of something. So, yeah, it does. It represents a pretty big shift, I reckon.
Did you have something to add, Kai? You looked like you wanted to add something there.
Boo-hoo. No, I'm just saying, I think the world has moved on, and I think gaming was probably one of the last holdouts where we had physical discs, because we don't do it in any other part of our lives. No other software is delivered on discs anymore, other than maybe sort of the very antiquated legacy software in some large businesses in the basement somewhere. And the revival that we have in music, where stuff is coming out on vinyl, I don't think we have that in games. I don't think we will see floppy disks anytime soon.
Oh, I wish we did.
No, they definitely do. Yeah, they have. They've released them on floppy disks. Well, there is still a nostalgia to the format. It's interesting. Look,
and I think the nostalgia still exists, and it exists in vinyl. And I think it's very much worth preserving that. But there's a difference to that and the economies of releasing lots and lots of games for broad audiences at scale with lots of ongoing updates. And frankly, for smaller game developers and independents, it's much cheaper to do this online than having to invest in a physical distribution. And so I think it has also broadly improved access to a market, at least on PC, right? The consoles are a different game. I mean, you know, the idea that Microsoft moves back to wanting to really stress the platform the flat platform business, right? It's sort of a toss-up between being a publisher, we publish broadly all kinds of games for all kinds of platforms, and wanting to strengthen Xbox and having exclusive releases. So I think that tension between broad accessibility and exclusivity is right there and alive. And I think we've sort of seen this move of laying off people to focus the core business is probably also a move to playing the platform card a little bit more, which again doesn't make it easier for broad accessibility. We might see some games being released only on Xbox, at least for a while, to drive people to buy the box rather than just releasing things broadly. So a lot of the competitive forces are at play here.
You are listening to Download the Show on ABC Radio National. Ray Johnston here with you. And the UN Secretary General has called for a ban on AI killer robots, which seems perfectly reasonable when you put it that way. Kai, what exactly is a killer robot?
That's a good question. To me, a killer robot is a device, a weapon that makes target choice, target selection autonomously, where it isn't a human that says, this is the target, and there might be some automation that guides the weapon to eliminating that target, where you put a thing in the field with some form of intelligence, in inverted quotes, that then makes choices as to what becomes a target and what to basically shoot at. And you entrust that to some kind of algorithm that is an autonomous weapon and a killer robot in my book. And whether this thing is flying or running or driving on wheels doesn't really make a difference.
Gianni, what part of this process is the UN trying to stop?
Well, if you think about what the UN was designed to do, was it was designed to foster that sort of inter-country communication and cooperation and all those things to stop another world war. So if you argue that of all the bits and pieces that the UN does, this is close to the most important thing that it does. Now, what they want to do is they want to basically have that there is a human intervention in between. And, you know, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said that, you know, those AI powered weapons, as we're describing there, we still sort of really don't know what that means because we're in this sort of weird Terminator future. But that the decision, particularly for taking another person's life in a war context or other context, should be a human decision being made, not being made automatically by machines. But, you know, it's when we talked about this in years past, it was sort of a bit more hypothetical, but we're much closer to the truth of that happening right now than we've ever been.
Yeah, I do remember talking about this 10 years ago. I remember covering a story very similar to this on Gizmodo. The headline did have killer robots in it. I believe it was AI expert Toby Walsh, Professor Toby Walsh, that was presenting to the UN on this topic at that time. So what's changed in the last 10 years to make the UN make this statement once again, Kai?
Hardware, Ukraine war, and generative AI. So we have much more sort of affordable consumer-grade hardware like drones. In the Ukraine war, we have seen the use of said drones at scale in order to enable Ukrainian forces to be nimble and defend their territory. Now, to be fair, a lot of these drones are human-operated. They're not autonomous. But the same technology that allows you to have a human-operated drone, with, you know, where a human looks through a camera, you can then also pair up with an AI that makes decisions. And this is where these large, big foundation models, they're more than language models because they're trained on video and all kinds of visual data as well, come into play, where now the fear is that you're basically taking these drones, bipedal robots, we've made lots of progress there, and pair them
up. The ones that walk around like people.
Yeah, that look a bit more like the Terminator.
fantastic present we're living in. This is awesome.
Where you then put an AI model behind that to make those choices. Now, the problem is that when we talk about a decision to pick a target, right? When a human makes that decision, there's a judgment involved that takes into account future consequences, that takes into account the humanity of, you know, what you're looking at, the context in which this happens. When you entrust this to an AI algorithm, what you basically have is you're connecting a prediction based on some visual data directly to an action. and you're taking this judgment out of the equation. And the by the very nature, these models have an error rate, right? They're never fully accurate because they make a prediction on the basis of past patterns. And you then basically take into account that there is an error rate, and we don't know what that is, but it can be double digits. And so you're basically saying that whatever this AI comes up with as a prediction, we basically connect that to the action to fire. And then what? You know, who knows what target got picked and what margin of error is there and whether or not we are picking the wrong target with no human oversight or judgment of the consequences or the context in which this is happening. So that's the frightening bit.
Absolutely. Kai, this sounds horrifying.
Correct me if I'm wrong as well. I think probably the biggest change really in the last 10 years versus when we were talking about it a decade ago was really that in the past, computer vision, the way that computers looked at the world through their cameras, has come such an incredibly long way in that they're able to actually visually recognize things in a way that we previously couldn't. So you're the expert in this area.
That sort of seems to be
the difference. Yeah.
But it's sort of we tend to then also make false conclusions. Just because it's gotten better doesn't mean it's gotten precise and 100% accurate, right? So we are better at distinguishing smaller things, moving things, and all that, even in blurry vision. But it still comes with a high error rate. And we know this from, you know, all kinds of tests. And then the question is, who's prepared to actually accept that error rate? And I think that's what everyone's worried about. And not just that responsible nations would deploy these technologies, but that when these technologies are being developed and hardware is becoming cheaper, that they end up in the wrong hands of rogue actors who might not care.
Yeah.
Right? They might just use them to indiscriminately trying to, you know, instill terror.
Is a global ban achievable, Gianni? Do we think that this could ever possibly happen, especially considering how slow regulation is in the tech industry in general, but particularly around AI? I'm struggling to see how this could be enforced.
We used to ban lots of different weapons, and there's many conventions around the world saying that, you know, chemical weapons and, you know, nuclear non-proliferation was something, you know, that countries signed up for and abided by. But we are sort of starting to see a number of countries decide that they're not going to abide by those rules. And so really it's sort of dependent upon, you know, whether or not anyone buys into the idea that we're all global citizens, we need to work and agree on something together. You know, I remember, like, there was a time in this world, and it doesn't feel that long ago, where the world banned CFCs and the ozone hole was able to be repaired, right? But it doesn't feel like we're in that moment anymore.
Oh, gosh. What's your thoughts on this, Kai? Is a ban achievable?
These are components that are used in all kinds of everyday applications, right? The drones are used in, you know, filming, photography, geolocation. They're used in all kinds of infrastructure-related business activities. These are the same drone hardware that are being used in the Ukraine war to help Ukraine. But, you know, we have access to these models. We have access to sort of 3D printed weapons and things like that. So, you know, is it worth for the UN to get involved and for society to have a good hard look at it and have a conversation about it? Absolutely. And is it worthwhile discussing what components might be restricted in terms of access? Yes. And I hope we can do that before something actually happens.
All right, let's move on from dystopian killer robots and Xbox taking away all of our gaming discs. Gianni, tell me about some tech that has brought you joy this week.
Can I tell you, this fits in really nicely. I went and bought an old refurbished laptop the other day. And it's waiting for me. It's literally just arrived. It's in the mailroom downstairs. And I'm really excited about that, because that's a really cool thing, is that when we can keep technology running for as long as possible and we're not reliant upon subscription services to keep old hardware running, it's actually like it's a really good thing from from an environmental perspective, from a technology perspective, and all of those sorts of things. And recycling is like a really cool thing and something I'm very passionate about when it comes to technology. So, yeah, I think last time I was on, I was talking about wired headphones, and now I'm talking about old laptops. So, you know, for a tech reporter, I'm pretty firmly in the past in many respects. So,
what about you, Kai? What's some tech that's brought you joy this week?
Well, first of all, Gianni, good on you. I'm keeping an old compact laptop.
Wow, compact.
Yeah, I know.
Vintage.
But yeah, it can still run the non-internet connected Age of Empires, the original edition, right? A piece of tech that has recently brought me joy, about a year and a half ago, I got back into gaming. So season 14 of Diablo 4 has given me joy playing with friends every other night for a couple of hours. Yeah, it's a really good a respite from the rest of the day, just to go in there, collect some items, kill some monsters, and I'm enjoying it.
Fantastic.
So the social aspect of it as well.
Kai Riemer, Professor at the University of Sydney Business School, thank you so much for joining us on Download This Show. Where can people find you and your work?
You can find me on LinkedIn and at work at Sydney Executive Plus, plus.sydney.edu.au.
Fantastic. And Gianfranco Di Giovanni, games reporter at ABC Arts and 102.5 ABC Perth content director. Thank you for coming on Download This Show again. Where can people find you and your work?
Yeah, so this week it's a big week for me. I've done two cool stories that are slightly different that I think people might be interested in having a look at. One for ABC Classic, where we talk to the composers behind the games League of Legends and the TV series Arcane, which was a spin-off of that. So that's a really cool article. You can go and have a listen to that one on your ABC Listen app, as well as also for ABC Arts. I've just done a really cool feature for NAIDOC Week with a bunch of First Nations games creators and talking about how they're using video games to tell cultural stories. So that's really cool. So have a look on the ABC Arts website for that one.
Fantastic. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And now some more tech news from the week that was. In case you missed it, Telstra has confirmed a nationwide outage of the network this week was caused by a software defect in network time synchronisation servers at data centres in Sydney and in Melbourne, not a cyber attack. The outage affected mobile calls, internet services, FPOS terminals, train networks, and more than 300 attempted 000 calls, prompting federal investigations into the incident and renewed scrutiny of Australia's telecommunications infrastructure. Assistant Minister for Technology Andrew Charlton has warned that advanced artificial intelligence systems are displaying behaviour its creators did not intend, as the newly established Australian AI Safety Institute begins testing frontier AI models. The Institute is working with regulators and researchers to measure how these systems behave, identify emerging risks, and help shape safety standards as governments continue debating AI regulation, copyright, and public trust in the technology. And growing investment in artificial intelligence infrastructure is placing increasing pressure on electricity grids and water supplies as companies race to build more data centres. New analysis published in The Guardian this week argues governments need stronger oversight to ensure the economic benefits of AI outweigh the environmental costs, with Australia's data centre energy and water use expected to rise sharply as demand for AI computing continues to grow. And that's all for this week. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. We're working on a special episode that answers all of your technology questions, especially the ones that you're afraid to ask. So send them over to downloadtheshow@abc.net.au, or you can slide into my DMs on Instagram at Ray Johnston. A big thanks to my producer, Jessie Kay, for this episode, which was produced on the lands of the Gadigal, Burramuttigal, Darug, Gundungra and Wurundjeri peoples. I'm Ray Johnston, and you've been listening to Download This Show.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.